on freshair.org.uk.
This is Edinburgh Student Radio Station.
I would listen to this.
This is Fresh Air.
The time has just gone 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 24th of February. You're listening to the Fresh Air News Hour with me, Ollie Lewis. A very busy show for you this evening. We hope to bring you insight on local, national and, of course, international news. Here's what's coming up before 7. A momentous day of history for the world as Russia begins an invasion of Ukraine. Putin's Air Force is thought to be targeting multiple cities across Ukraine as many civilians head for safety on the western border. NATO, the EU, the UK and other democratic powers have condemned the invasion in the strongest of terms. We'll bring you up to date with all the latest also tonight. Looking to Edinburgh, we continue with our series with interviews with major Scottish politicians to ask them about the state of British politics and any potential implications for student populations. Tonight we'll hear from Miles Briggs, an MSP for the Scottish Conservatives. And later on in the programme, we'll be speaking live with Ed Holtham, a student journalist making national news with his work looking into university finances during the pandemic. It's going to be a great show, and we start with the news headlines very shortly. Boris Johnson has announced a new package of sanctions against the Russian state. Speaking in the last hour, the Prime Minister told MPs that the government would be implementing the largest and most severe package of economic sanctions that Russia has ever seen. Russian banks will have their assets frozen and will be excluded from the UK's financial system. Aeroflot, Russia's national airline, will be banned from the UK, and there will be a limit on deposits that Russians can make into UK banks. The move comes after President Vladimir Putin's forces entered Ukraine in the early hours of this morning in what the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, called an all-out invasion. Condemnation has come in from around the world. President Biden is shortly due to make an address to the American people, announcing similar sanctions to those just announced by Boris Johnson. In other news, all COVID restrictions have been lifted in England over 2 years since when the pandemic began. From today, people will not be obliged by law to self-isolate, even if they have a positive COVID test, and masks will no longer be required in many public settings. Scotland is due to take the same move on the 21st of March. And finally, the Queen has cancelled more virtual appointments today, days after testing positive for COVID-19. Buckingham Palace says that she continues to undertake light duties. It's 6:07. Well, good evening. Welcome to the Fresh Air News Hour. It's great to have you with me. A huge day, as I said in my introduction, a momentous day in history. And it's a real pleasure to be on air when such important things are going on around the world. So, yes, finally we have it. We've expected for weeks, haven't we, that this kind of thing might happen. We've feared that it might happen, a Russian invasion of Ukraine. But we were always promised by politicians around the world that a diplomatic solution was still possible. Perhaps it was possible a number of days ago. It is not anymore. In the early hours of this morning, Vladimir Putin's forces did indeed invade Ukraine. Boris Johnson has made a statement in the last hour. We heard in the news headlines just then. This is part of what he had to say. Some very strong words.
Putin will stand condemned in the eyes of the world and of history. He will never be able to cleanse the blood of Ukraine from his hands. And although the UK and our allies tried every avenue for diplomacy until the final hour, I'm driven to conclude that Putin was always determined to attack his neighbour, no matter what we did.
So a bit of an admission there from Boris Johnson that as he did say in the last few weeks, he was always convinced that Putin was set on attacking Ukraine. The session in Parliament that is still going on as we speak, as we are on air at 8 minutes past six. It's been a symbolic session. Of course, it began with Boris Johnson beginning to announce those sanctions, those very heavy sanctions, mainly of a financial nature, on Russia and Russians indeed. This is what Keir Starmer had to say in response to the Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this must be a turning point in history. We must look back and say that this terrible day was actually when Putin doomed himself and doomed his plan to reassert Russian force as a means of controlling Eastern Europe to defeat. We know how Putin operates, so we know how to defeat him.
Keir Starmer there, the Labour leader. It's interesting to kind of chart the change in the opposition position in the last years. Of course, Jeremy Corbyn widely seen to be deeply sceptical of a lot of British foreign policy decisions in the last few decades. His opposition within the Labour Party and on the Conservative benches would level that he was even sceptical of NATO itself. That is, of course, something that only he can answer. But condemnation and action has come not only from within the UK. If you want a sense of the gravity of the situation, this is what the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg had to say this afternoon.
We now have war in Europe on a scale and of a type we thought belonged to history.
Quite a stark sentiment there from Jens Stoltenberg. This is, as I said, a huge day in history. And I guess the question really as we come on air this evening is where does it leave us? We know that Putin's forces are continuing to target cities in Ukraine. But we are uncertain where this leaves us, I think. Sanctions in the last few weeks appear not to have deterred Putin in any way from taking action in Ukraine. So I guess only time will tell if these sanctions will do so. It does have to be said that the measures announced by Boris Johnson, and which will certainly be agreed by the British Parliament, in case anyone is in any doubt about that, they are the strongest that have been seen for many, many years, certainly stronger than anything seen in the last few weeks, or indeed, I would say, following the 2014 annexation of Crimea by Vladimir Putin's forces. So whether the extent of sanctions, you know, excluding Russian money virtually entirely from the UK financial system, is certainly something that potentially might hurt Vladimir Putin, hit him where it hurts. That is certainly the aim, but we will have to see whether that actually changes anything militarily on the ground. At the moment, it's obviously seems very, very unlikely that British or indeed NATO military forces will be directly involved in a conflict with Russia. The reason for that? Well, Ukraine isn't in NATO. Ukraine isn't a NATO member. And why is that significant? Well, because NATO says in Article 5 that an attack on one of its members is an attack on all of its members, and therefore other members must go to that member that has been attacked's side and aid them militarily. And therefore, NATO, if you like, will take sanctions, but in a way they have an excuse not to act militarily. They have an excuse not to invoke war because Ukraine is not a part of NATO. Now, of course, Ukraine has a border with NATO. Poland is a NATO member. There are countries that border Russia in the north, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, all of which are NATO members. So if Vladimir Putin does decide to up not just the rhetoric, but up the military might that he exerts in the next few weeks, getting closer towards perhaps Poland, let's say, a NATO member, that will change things. And in that case, we would be living in a very different and more dangerous world. We obviously hope it doesn't get to that situation, but we will have to see. We're going to keep on top of developments in the next hour because this is obviously such a fast-moving story that we can't really predict anything that's going to happen. And if there is any major breaking news, we will, of course, bring it to you. But next, this evening on the Fresh Air News Hour. Last week, I had the pleasure of introducing the first interview in a series that the Fresh Air News Hour is producing with politicians from around Scotland who have a Scottish and a national profile. Last week, I was lucky enough to sit down with Ian Murray from the Labour Party, who is the MP for Edinburgh South. Ian is also the Shadow Secretary of State for Scotland. We had a great conversation about the state of the Labour Party, the state of British politics. We did touch on Ukraine. And today, I'm really excited to offer you to to bring you my interview with Miles Briggs. Now, Miles is a member of the Scottish Parliament for the Lothian region, which, of course, includes Edinburgh. And I sat down with him a number of days ago. I will note that we didn't talk about Ukraine. That was a conscious choice because it being a number of days ago, we were aware of how fast changing the story was. And anything said a few days ago would probably have been out of date by the time it aired today. And we were proved right on that. So we chart a lot of issues relating to British politics, Scottish politics, independence, the Conservatives. And interestingly enough, Miles Briggs is one of those Conservatives that has called on Boris Johnson to resign in the last few months. So we have a very interesting chat about why he's done that. So we start our conversation by looking at civility or the lack thereof in British and Scottish politics. Take a listen. So we're joined on the Fresh Air News Hour now by Miles Briggs, MSP. Miles has been a Conservative member of the Scottish Parliament, serving the Lothian region since 2016. He served as the Scottish Conservative Chief Whip from 2020 to 2021, and before that was Shadow Scottish Conservative Cabinet Member covering health and sport between 2017 and 2020. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Ollie. That makes me feel very old, that list of introductions.
Anyway. Well, am I also right in saying that you're now in the Shadow Cabinet covering social justice, housing and local government?
That's it, yep. Probably the biggest title in politics, yep. So all those things, which is interesting. It's a huge portfolio, so I can jump around lots of issues.
Yes, it kind of relates to everyone. Kind of everyone has an opinion on housing issues and that kind of thing. So you've got a long list of experience, which is fantastic for our chat today. I'd like to start, if I may, with a kind of a broad discussion about the tone of politics that has changed a little bit over the last few years, and civility in politics and that kind of thing. On the day that we're recording this, in the last few hours, an article has come out in the Times, published written by Sarah Smith, who is the BBC's former Scotland editor, who has recently headed over to America to take over from John Sopel as their North America editor. And she's basically drawn a contrast between the political cultures in the US and in Scotland, because I think many people, including a lot of my listeners, would understand the US culture, in political terms at least, to be quite nasty, to be quite aggressive, especially at the moment in the last 5 years. And yet Sarah Smith has come out and said that actually Scotland is just as bad, if not even worse, and that it's full of misogyny and other hatred. Is that something you recognise?
I suppose her comments, as I've read them, were specifically post-referendum. I don't think she sort of says it's been like this for forever in Scottish politics. It's the sort of abuse which both sides, let's be honest, have been putting against each other in the run-up to the referendum for that two-year debate we had, and then since. I don't think that has necessarily gone away. So I suppose anyone involved in politics and journalists who are covering it face this barrage of abuse, and that hasn't stopped since the referendum. So sorry to say, I probably do recognise what she's saying. And it's just incredibly depressing that, a journalist like her, who is covering events, has faced that kind of attack. And the fact that she now thinks that, America is, I wouldn't say she's saying America's better. I think she's saying Scotland is as bad. And we know in American politics, the world of attack ads. Now, we don't have attack ads, but we do have social media attacks, which can be orchestrated, can be focused on individuals and messaging. So it's incredibly depressing. And, I hope at some point we can turn the page on this, but we certainly haven't since the referendum, and there's no sign of it going away at the minute either.
Mm-hmm. And hatred in politics and abuse must affect people on all sides, not just in politics, but in journalism. As a Conservative representative, how do you experience that? Because I imagine it's a slightly different kind of abuse to the abuse that members from the SNP or other left-wing parties might experience.
Yeah, I think probably most of it is social media instigated. And most of that, I'm incredibly thick-skinned. You have to be in politics. And so I ignore it. I don't engage with it like some colleagues might. And you kind of need to understand that people maybe go hunting for opportunities to attack politicians, regardless of the rosette they wear. And social media is a place where we will directly be available if you want to go after us on whatever topic of the day. But the wider issue I've had, and over the last few weeks I've been out with our council candidates, for example, and a lot of people who are standing are worried about what that means for them and their families, more importantly, often. when they're elected and when they become fair game for people to come and attack them. And I think that's really sad. And I ultimately think that puts people standing, puts people putting themselves forward to stand for election. And it's something, you know, I hope we can do something about, but we haven't. And it seems to be getting worse. As the years go on, as referendums, both in terms of independence, but also Brexit, have polarized people, made people take a binary choice, and therefore, you know, you're not with us, you're against us type arguments will always prevail in that sort of world. And just agreeing to disagree doesn't seem to necessarily work on social media. So, you know, it's a sad place to be, but I think by and large, it's also people go to social media looking for that space to have those arguments anyway.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And yeah, that's a great segue, because on a separate but related note, I guess the story that has dominated British politics in the last few months has been what is now being called Partygate, the issue of the Prime Minister potentially breaking his own lockdown rules. You have called for Boris Johnson to resign, echoing Douglas Ross, and who's your leader, of course, and many others in your party. I would just like to know, on a personal level, why have you a Conservative representative called for a Conservative Prime Minister to resign? It's a huge step. So just from you personally, why did you decide to do
that? Well, I think it was a very, very difficult decision for me to take. And it was one which, I agreed with where Douglas was on this. If we're going to set these laws, if we're going to say to people, you know, you cannot meet up and you cannot have these parties, and, you know, the restrictions we expected every single one of us to follow, I just felt you cannot have rules for different people. And the Prime Minister saying he wasn't at these when he clearly was, and it has admitted that since, I think it's unacceptable. And I think it undermines trust, and trust is very low in politics anyway. But for me, that was just a step too far. And I think it's really important that we're able to have politicians who, you know, if they're going to put these, and the pandemic was incredibly difficult, don't get me wrong, these sorts of laws no politician would ever imagine put in place, where you ban people from going into other people's homes, for example. So they were very challenging laws for people. But at the same time, when we're asking people to do that, we can't be in a position where the Prime Minister and his team were breaking these laws we're putting in place. So that's why I supported Douglas, and majority of my colleagues have been in the same space as well on this.
But what do you say to people who say that actually this is an incredibly strong argument for independence, and that the union is now in such a position that the Conservative Party can't even agree on who should lead it, such are the differences between England and Scotland, and that, you know, this is really played into the hands of the narrative of hating Westminster, that Westminster is completely detached from Scotland. That's quite a powerful argument, isn't it?
If you want to make that argument, I can understand why the SNP have jumped into that position. That's not where I've come to this issue. I think this is an individual in the Prime Minister who clearly, and his team, have not lived up to the expectations which we all set each other by putting in place these regulations. The First Minister, for example, was caught without her mask on. She apologised, and we've moved on from that. That didn't mean we jumped to say that's independence over, you know, that's the SNP finished on one issue. The Constitution is such a bigger, broader issue than any one politician, one Prime Minister, that, you know, this is a very personal issue for the Prime Minister to address, and the wrongdoings which took place on his watch, in his office, in his Downing Street. You know, the buck has to stop with him as Prime Minister. So I think that's where, for me, if you want to make it a constitution argument, which the SNP always do, then that's why they've jumped on this. But I think most people would say this not necessarily as that. It's a behavioural issue. It's not a constitutional issue.
I'm interested to know, have you always had your doubts about Boris Johnson? Because it's very well the whole of the Scottish Conservative Party coming out now against Boris Johnson and calling for him to resign. But he's been an unpopular figure in Scotland for a long time. A lot of people would say that the character flaws demonstrated by this scandal have been there for many years. And so have you always kind of held him at an arm's distance and always been comfortable him being there but not engaged directly, and that actually now you all have this excuse to get rid of him? Now it seems politically convenient, it seems like the right time to call for him to go.
Yeah, you know, in terms of the record around the Prime Minister, myself speaks for itself. I didn't support him to be Conservative Party leader. In hindsight, looking at his work as Prime Minister, I actually think he's focused on a lot of things I personally would welcome and support. The levelling up agenda is one which I have always felt all governments over the last 20 years haven't really focused upon. And I think there's a lot of positive work he's trying to achieve around that. So in some ways, you know, my lack of support for him becoming Conservative Party leader, he's actually gone on and done things which I support. As Prime Minister during a pandemic, I actually think he's done well, and most people might not draw that conclusion, but looking at some of the key decisions which we took as a country around furlough, and especially the most successful vaccination programme anywhere in the world, you know, these were things he led. He made sure billions of pounds of funding were put in to develop that vaccine, which has now driven us to such a great place where we are in the pandemic. That means, you know, these are successes, but, you know, I can't get away from the fact that I didn't want him to be Conservative Party leader. I didn't support him to. But, you know, this issue has not been the reason why I've decided that I think he can't carry on as Prime Minister with what's gone on.
Just briefly on the pandemic, we will come back to the Prime Minister. People often reference, in support of the Prime Minister, the two examples you have, furlough and the vaccine programme. And I think it is undeniable that both of those things really advance us as a country and improve people's lives. And people, I think, on quite, you know, a large scale are very grateful for those decisions made by Boris Johnson. But do you concede that there were a number of catastrophically bad decisions also made by Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock and the rest of his top team? You know, I'm talking about discharging people from care homes. Yep. Discharging people from hospital with COVID right back into care homes. You know, we're talking about ignoring all calls for a firebreak lockdown back in the autumn of 2020 and then going back into a severe full lockdown in winter. They really did not get a lot of the big calls right.
Yeah, and hindsight's a great thing in politics, if only we all had it. But yes, no, I do. And, you know, personally speaking, I was Shadow Health Secretary during that time. I was raising alarms looking in, you know, within the Scottish Government context of this, because looking at Italy, it was quite clear that, you know, vulnerable older people who were most susceptible to get COVID and die from COVID were in care homes. You know, the nature of someone who's in a care home, they are clinically vulnerable. And I, you know, I was raising these concerns because we saw the pattern happening in Italy, and across the UK we didn't stop. You know, to some extent, it's a very difficult decision to say stop. You know, discharging patients from a hospital setting into a care home setting when they clinically should be, and that's what we would want in usual times. But we could see what was happening, and I think both governments in Scotland and at UK level could have actually done some work around that to prevent and slow down that spread of the virus. But, you know, these are very difficult decisions at the time. And when you're trying to basically shift the NHS purely towards focusing on, you know, that pandemic response, these decisions were taken. And to some extent, one of the meetings I had early on in the pandemic, and it was a private meeting with the chief medical officer and also with all opposition spokespeople, we were being told things which, you know, really sent shivers down my spine. So we were talking about each council planning mass graves, that letters would go to relatives to tell them that, you know, the Queen was actually going to be writing letters to each individual family to, you know, send condolences, but people wouldn't be going to funerals. People would be buried in mass graves. And that was the planning which was going on at the very start of this pandemic, which was terrifying. You know, I was sitting in these meetings having never seen this. A lot of the work which was designed actually at the beginning of the pandemic was actually the same modelling we did when we had mad cow disease and how we dealt with animals. So It was a really terrifying time. And you can see why public servants, especially in the NHS, had to take quick decisions and not necessarily sort of look at the real unintended consequences of what that would mean. And no government in the world got this all right. And the future sort of planning, I think, and hope will be really looked at now. And that can be shared globally, not just individually, for individual countries' responses.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think we can all agree that certainly no government anywhere got all the decisions right. That would be impossible. Just finally, on the issue of current news and politics that's been going on, you have called for Boris Johnson to resign. Do you have anyone in mind that you would like to succeed him?
It depends who puts themselves forward, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things which I would say I'm pleased about is there are a number of people who would make very good prime ministers, I believe, within my party down in Westminster. So personally, I supported Jeremy Hunt last time. I think he is a talent which is not being utilised. I think that's one of my criticisms of the prime minister. He should have actually had a government of all the talents. And someone like Jeremy Hunt should have been in that government. So I'm not pinning my support on Jeremy Hunt, but I think there's people like that. I hope if we do get to that position of a leadership contest, really look towards what they can offer and where we can move the country forward. Because recovery has to be our number one focus now. And I think that's one of the things, all the distractions within politics, which we see around this issue and Partygate, is getting in the way of us actually getting back to what is a really important agenda for the country and the government focusing on making sure that all the energies are going into that, not this sort of firefighting which we've seen.
So that was the first half of my interview with Miles Briggs from the Scottish Conservatives. Very interesting, I thought, what he was saying about Boris Johnson, about his character, and indeed, just at the end there, who he would like to see succeed him if indeed Boris Johnson does resign in the coming weeks and months. Obviously, that party political aspect of the conversation has changed hugely, I think, in the last few days, given the crisis in Ukraine. You know, we might see a kind of rally around the flag effect, is what pollsters call it, when people in politics and around the country and around the world get behind their leaders in times of crisis. Who knows if that will change the dynamics? It will also, be relevant when the Met Police's inquiry into Partygate concludes. But we're going to carry on straight away with Miles and the interview. We've got a lot to pack into today's show. So we started this next part of our interview, which is the second half, on the issue of independence. Of course, he is a member of the Scottish Conservatives, and so he's a unionist. Here's what he had to say. Something that you at least would certainly see as a distraction is the issue of Scottish independence, which keeps returning to politics. So last year in the Scottish elections, a majority of Scottish parliamentarians were elected who support Scottish independence and another referendum. So what is the democratic case for not having another referendum?
Oh, I go back to the referendum we had and the election which David Cameron, following the election of a majority SNP government, did the Edinburgh Agreement, signed in the capital here with Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond, Nick Clegg at the time, and the Prime Minister signed that to allow that legally binding, once in a lifetime, once in a generation referendum. We had that. To go back to your first question, it was nasty, it was bitter. And we settled that argument, and I think we need to move on from that. I understand the SNP, didn't win that, and for anyone who doesn't win an argument, doesn't win a vote, they want to rerun it, and, second, third, fourth, fifth, 20th time lucky might be their hope in the future. But we can't run a country like that. You can't have a democracy which constantly is dragged back like this. So I want us to see us move on, and I think the majority of people do not see this, especially coming out of the pandemic, as a priority. Most polling shows it's not in people's top eight issues. So that's where I think we need to move on. And, being in Parliament for the last 5 years, I've seen at least five launches like this from the current First Minister, saying that there will be a referendum this year. I doubt really in her heart of hearts she thinks there will be. But she has to keep her base motivated. And that's exactly what seems to be happening at the moment with this talk of another referendum. It's certainly not, for me, and for most people coming out of the pandemic, the priority they want to see at this current point in time.
But nonetheless, if you believe, and you're right, that a lot of polling shows that independence isn't necessarily the top priority for a lot of people, why do you think people keep going back to the SNP? Last year they very nearly won a majority. They are polling very strongly. They continue to do so, both on a personal level for Nicola Sturgeon and on a party level. If it's not about independence, what is it about?
Well, the First Minister has to look at her messaging on this, and the fact that the SNP has been successful is not purely on independence. In fact, I was looking at an article this morning which the SNP ran in the last week of the campaign, which said voting SNP wasn't about independence, because they knew they were trying to look for a reward from the pandemic. Most leaflets, if people read them or even remember them, the last leaflet the SNP were doing was the podium and leadership and talking about, you know, putting Nicola Sturgeon back to get through the pandemic. It didn't mention independence on any of these cards and leaflets. So, you know, the SNP, all parties win votes on different issues. I wouldn't say an election is necessarily that testing of public opinion. And Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP were very keen to not say that voting for them was about that. But they failed to win a majority. I think that's one of the key tests. And although Nicola Sturgeon will never probably do an interview while she's in the position she is to say that she was disappointed, I think she was. I think the SNP genuinely thought they would get a majority, that she would beat the heights of Alex Salmond's
majority. They only finished one or two seats short of a majority, though, of course, so not far off.
Yes, but in terms of where the previous First Minister, her mentor, had beat the system, if you like, and had won that majority. Since then, they've obviously brought the Greens into this coalition or working relationship. But I think they were probably disappointed that they didn't get the result they thought they would. And that was probably a test of the public not wanting to see necessarily another referendum as well, that when push came to shove, they didn't necessarily get the predicted level of support and seats. You know, they were predicted to get a majority of 10 seats at one point. The pollsters kind of got this election wrong again. But that was a key issue, I think, that really hasn't necessarily given them the same momentum or mandate which they had for the first referendum back in 2014.
Sure, and although independence doesn't seem to be high on the political agenda right now, you talk about the SNP working with the Greens in government to achieve that kind of majority for a second referendum. Would you ever countenance the Conservative Party working with other unionist parties in order to oppose that kind of referendum?
Yeah, and for, you know, politically, that's kind of what we've still having to do to this date with a lot of unionist parties. I think the council elections, you know, shouldn't be about this, but will be a head count to some extent on unionist and pro-independence voters. And, you know, the key thing for me is trying to turn the page on that constitutional argument, because it is holding us back as a country in so many areas. The political energy which we have put into this issue, really now over the last decade, just imagine if that had gone into other issues, if that had gone into trying to sort, you know, our homelessness crisis or sort our NHS or to look at education issues in this country. Imagine if we were all actually trying to push each other towards these solutions and offering ideas, the better country we would have built. So, you know, it's not something which makes me jump out of bed to say, great, I'm going to fight this independence referendum away. But obviously on the other side of that coin, for most people who are in the SNP, it's just about independence. It's not necessarily about these issues. So I want us to get back to focusing on the issues which the Scottish Parliament has all these powers over and we're not using, or we're not necessarily really looking at how we can improve the country collectively. Because I think across all parties, there's good work, there's good ideas, but it always comes back to this divisive constitutional question.
I'd like to talk about students. This is, of course, Student Radio. The majority of our listeners will be students and young people or their families. Just firstly, like to clarify a few things. Am I right in saying that the Scottish Conservatives oppose tuition fees in Scotland?
Yes, so we have changed our position and we do not want to see tuition fees brought in. And, you know, some of the work we've been doing around this has also been around how we can change funding, especially around college places as well, because we've lost over 100,000 college places in Scotland. So there's a broader issue around what we want to see. But yes, we do not support reintroducing tuition fees in Scotland.
Yeah, and given that you are a pro-unionist party, in theory, is that also what you'd like to see UK-wide?
Well, in terms of our colleagues down south, you know, it's for them to make their mind up. But yes, I think some of the arguments which we did change our position, got to be 100% honest with that. And that's because we listened to people, listened to students and families saying that they wouldn't be able to afford to go to university. And actually that debt which people have, and people even without tuition fees, let's be honest, have a lot of debt in Scotland, but it was a deciding factor. And I know from family, from friends down south, that that is also an issue. So yeah, I would like to see across the UK as look at this and revisit it as well. Because, you know, I was lucky enough to go to university. I wouldn't have probably gone if there was tuition fees either. So it's an issue I think we should really consider across the UK again.
But this, again, highlights, doesn't it, the separation between the rest of the UK and Scotland in terms of politics, the Scottish Conservatives.
This is devolution. We can relax and have, you know, different councils do different things. We don't say, oh, Orkney and Shetland better be chucked out of the Scotland because they're doing a different policy. You know, devolution was meant to be like this. Let's be relaxed about it. Priorities will be different in different parts of the UK. They're different in different parts of England as well. You know, that's where, for me, I don't really see an issue with this. This is just a political decision. If people don't like it, they'll vote for another party and elect a different government. But it doesn't need to always be, oh, in that case, let's get the border built. Mm-hmm. You know, independence is not going to solve a lot of these problems. Maybe it feels like it would, and people would feel they're, who support independence anyway, feel that there might be something better. There might actually be something worse in real terms. But, you know, I don't think we always need to be like trying to change the constitution when there's a problem. We can do different policies, and devolution gives us that opportunity to. I would like to see more devolution in Scotland. The central belt.
What kind of thing?
Well, I think pushing power out to different parts of the country is something I would like to see. Edinburgh is being held back by a lot of national infrastructure projects where we don't get our fair share. You know, I've been banging on for 5 years the fact that Edinburgh City Council and NHS Lothian, our health board, get the lowest funding per head of population, yet we have the fastest growing population anywhere in Scotland. We also have the same issues which other parts of the country get additional funding for. We don't seem to be getting that fair deal. So, you know, I would like to see ways of changing how we run. You know, we're seeing that slowly, but the concentration which we don't give to see how actually we can really get Scotland's economy going and really look maybe potentially at different ways of devolving power, having city mayors, for example, things like that, or city provosts, might really start to give parts of Scotland a stronger voice to take on the Scottish government as well, not just this notion that it's, you know, Holyrood against Westminster. As parts of Scotland feel very neglected by this SNP government as well.
On the cost of living, which is a crisis that I think students are really feeling at the moment, as of course everyone is, what more do you think in the immediate term could be being done by Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish government to mitigate the effects of this, which I must say we're all feeling. Sure. Because I was in one of the big supermarkets the other day, and I was buying the exact same product that I had bought the week before, and it had literally gone up 20p in a week. And, you know, I was lucky enough that I could still afford to buy that, but that applied across a long period of time to many products. That really adds up for students, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a very difficult issue, especially around cost of products and foods, because a lot of that is actually around the transportation of these goods. So, you know, most containers coming into Scotland or into the UK have seen around about a cost of £1,000 added onto those containers, and that's been added onto every single product within them. So, you know, where that transportation costs and energy costs being one of the key ones is where the government can press down on these issues. I think in terms of the Scottish Parliament, we were trying to press the Scottish government to make sure that councils didn't have to increase council tax. These decisions are being taken over the next couple of weeks by local authorities. It looks about 3% increase might be the average, but that's another cost people will face with council tax. And I would hope, and the Chancellor has moved to do some work, but I hope there's more coming around how we can push down on energy costs, because come April, that's going to be one of the key issues. A lot of people who are in fuel poverty already need that additional help and support. I also think for some people, debt advice issues need to also be really looked into, because we don't have necessarily the support available for where people really get into problematic debt. So I'd like to see more done across these areas as soon as possible, because, you know, we know the crisis is on the horizon now. In fact, a lot of people are already reporting it, but the energy prices increasing by 50% in April is going to push people across the country into fuel poverty. And so every single lever we've got, both in Holyrood at council level and also in Westminster, I hope we'll all be pulling to try to support families, individuals and businesses across the country.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, Miles Briggs, MSP. Thank you very much for coming on Fresh Air.
Thanks very much. Good to see you, Ollie. Thanks.
Now, that was my interview with Miles Briggs, who is a Scottish Conservative member of the Scottish Parliament. That was a really enjoyable conversation and the second of our four interviews with politicians from around Scotland. Last week, we heard from Ian Murray. We were supposed to be hearing from Christine Jardine from the Lib Dems this week, but she is currently speaking in the debate in the House of Commons. So we will hopefully rearrange that and I will let you know when that will be. We're hoping to speak to Tommy Shepherd of the SNP on the 10th of March. But again, these things are due to change given current events. And I will keep you in the loop. Now, next up on the News Hour, I'm joined in the studio live by Ed Holtom. Ed is a fourth year politics student. Welcome to Fresh Air. You are actually the first person I've had in the studio for a very long time. Thank you so much for coming on.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So the reason I've got you on the show today is that you've recently had two articles published, one in a national publication and one in a local Edinburgh publication, about issues relating to not just the University of Edinburgh, but the UK university sector more widely. Let's start with your article that was featured on no less than the front page of The Telegraph on Sunday. Congratulations about that.
Thank you.
The headline was Russell Group Universities Profiting from Students' Misery After Amassing £2.2 billion pounds cash surplus. What's that all about?
Well, you know, I started looking into the way the Russell Group finances were working, partly because of my own dissatisfaction with how my course seemed to be being delivered at the University of Edinburgh. And it's sort of was just so eye-popping, like just really caught me by surprise how these institutions are operating with so much cash in the bank. And so I, from that, started to conduct a Freedom of Information campaign. So I submitted Freedom of Information requests to all of the Russell Group universities. Some of them came back to me, some of them obfuscated on giving answers to very simple questions like how much money did you have off furlough? So I was just looking into that, and basically the reality is, I think that, you know, we all know that these institutions have got a lot of cash on hand, and, you know, if they chose to give students a fairer deal, then they could quite easily do that.
So I think the figure that I read in your article relating to furlough, so the amount of money that universities took via the furlough scheme, was £115 million. Why did you see that? And clearly people at The Telegraph and other journalists, why do you see that to be controversial, that amount of money?
I think With that figure of £150 million, you know, that's a lot of taxpayer money. And in the context of the fact that, you know, English students are still paying through the nose for their tuition fees and paying them back at a very high rate of interest, the fact that on top of that, in the context of their surplus, they also felt it necessary to take hundreds of millions of pounds off the British taxpayer as well, just seemed pretty alarming, to be honest. And actually, not all of the Russell Groups did choose to make use of the furlough scheme. Queen Mary University made the principal decision not to because of the healthy state of its finances. And, you know, I think the article just goes to show that actually the rest of the Russell Group probably could have made that decision as well.
Yeah, so the NUS, the National Union of Students, have come out and called this, quotes, truly appalling. What other kind of, have you had any other receptions, either publicly or privately, that you're willing to reveal from, you know, people supporting your work, saying that it's interesting?
Well, the Telegraph article had quite a few comments online from parents, mainly, people that has been sending their children to universities over this period that were very unhappy, and I've seen, you know, it's the numbers 2.2 billion and 115 million have been sort of picked up around various different media outlets. So, for example, in the Daily Mail as well, they've had a reaction, a comment piece from a academic writing also endorsing the idea of tuition fee rebates. Daisy Cooper, deputy leader of the Lib Dems, said that she would support an investigation into the Russell Group finances. So, you know, there has been some momentum building behind this idea of tuition fee rebates in response to the very clear state, the healthy state of the Russell Group finance.
So I guess the controversy here isn't only the fact that British universities have a lot of money in their banks. The controversy here is that this has happened at a time when students have been paying the exact same fees for a service that most people agree has been significantly, or at least partially, worse than it was before.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 2 years ago, I thought, this is great. All of my teaching is cancelled. I've got no exams going on, like, winner for me. And sort of 2 years, it became quite evident quite quickly that, you know, they really were not going to be delivering the kind of shift that they had promised. And I think that the issue is that if you're going to treat education as a commodity and you're going to brand yourself as being a world-leading institution, and so you're effectively making students pay for a service, if the service that you deliver is quite frankly not up to scratch and not up to what you were promised, then I think, in all honesty, you should be entitled to a refund. The controversy continues to grow today. Their front page of the Times has been shown that the government is going to be lowering the threshold at which students have to start repaying their tuition fees. So that would mean students are going to be paying back more money earlier on, and they're also going to be scrapping the idea that if you haven't paid them back after 30 years, they'll write them off. You're going to be paying that until you retire. So if you don't earn above £25,000, say, over the course of your career a year, then you're looking at paying over £100,000 back in tuition fees with interest added, which just seems an extortionate number.
Yeah, because it's interesting how this kind of movement has changed from it used to only be anti-tuition fees. It was in principle opposed to the idea of tuition fees. It's now moved to actually more than scrap tuition fees, but actually we need refunds, we need rebates for the quality of education that we've had in the last few years. Listening to Miles Briggs just there from the Scottish Conservatives, they as a party are now opposed to tuition fees in Scotland, which at least for Scottish students is now the situation that they find themselves in. It's different for English students or international students. From the reception of your article and just your general sense of politics in this country, how likely do you think it is that some kind of change to the way that students pay for university tuition will happen over the next few years, whether that's tuition fees, whether that's some kind of partial rebate? Do you get a sense that there is any kind of momentum that will actually change things?
There is actually a consultation happening in the UK government at the moment about higher education funding and KPIs for learning objectives, making sure that a certain quality of teaching is delivered to students when they pay for this course. I think it is interesting what you say about the shift in the conversation, but I think, you know, as ideologically, we would all love to not have to pay for the tuition fees, but unfortunately you kind of have to meet these institutions and the government where they are now and try and be pragmatic about it. I think going forward, I personally would like to see an inquiry into the way that the Rus Group has handled their finances over the course of the pandemic. There does seem to be growing cross-party support for at least the idea of the refund. In terms of a shift in the way that tuition fees are paid for, I don't know. Who's to say? It's not. I don't think that Labour is necessarily going to adopt that. They're trying to.
Well, I was speaking to Ian Murray last week, who is in the Shadow Cabinet, and he really would not be drawn on the issue of what Labour's policy on tuition fees will be at the next election.
I actually contacted the Shadow Secretary of State for Education to ask if she had anything to comment on it.
Kate Phillipson, that would be.
I think it's Bridget Phillipson.
Forgive me. Yeah,
and but she would not be drawn either. She would not offer a comment on it.
Interesting.
Which I think is a shame, because it sort of feels like, well, who is looking out for the students then? If you know the Conservatives are quite frankly doing more on this issue than the Labour Party are at the moment.
Sure. So let's talk about your second article that's come out recently. This was for the Edinburgh Tab. This was more specific to the University of Edinburgh and strike action that's going on. What was this article about?
So the second article was actually sort of a result of the Freedom of Information campaign I did against Edinburgh University specifically. I actually submitted the FOI way back in July 2020.
Wow.
And I've sort of been sitting on that information, not really knowing what to do with it. Yeah. But basically, when the lecturers and academic staff that are members of the UCU go on strike, the University of Edinburgh does dock their pay. So over a 9-day period of striking in February and March 2020, there was a deduction in salaries of over £500,000. So quick maths ended up with a figure of £57,000 a day. The University of Edinburgh states that they will put this, put any wage deductions from striking into a student opportunity fund, which is a means-tested fund that you can apply up to £250 if you can prove how your education has been negatively impacted, which I think is a bit of a slap in the face. So
this,
to be honest,
this is not a kind of blanket fund or a blanket opportunity for students around the university. This is for people who take the time to prove, you know, with evidence that their learning has been interrupted. So what exactly did the university say on this? They said that that was basically where the money that they save goes.
That was all they had to say. The only comment was, have a look at our student opportunity fund. This is what we're this is what we're doing with it. I think that you know, it would be an interesting question to ask. Well, how many people actually did receive payments out of that?
Of course, yeah, because if they're saving, you know, over a period of, let's say, 9 days, as you say, if they save £500,000 and they're offering grants of £200 or £300 to individual students, that's quite a few individual grants that need to be successfully given out in order for that money to be, you know, fairly distributed. Do you have anything else in the pipeline? You seem to be doing a lot of investigation into universities.
I'm quite curious at the moment about, I mean, I know specifically for Edinburgh, you know, they've had £10.5 million from the furlough programme just themselves. So they were responsible for almost 10% of the total figure across the Russell Group. And, you know, they saved £6.2 million from the closure of all their facilities in the first 4 months of pandemic as well. Now, when you ask those same questions, they say that they don't have the figures on hand. So I'm interested in what's changed in the accounting that means they can't give a straight answer on those issues. I'm also interested in the fact that we are in a difficult situation as students because the terms and conditions we sign don't necessarily entitle us to a refund because we have to sign a specific waiver against pandemic disruption. Which is something that changed between 2019 and 2020.
Yeah, talk to me about this. So that existed before the pandemic, or that's
a new addition at the University of Edinburgh.
Right.
They rephrased their liability section of the terms and conditions, which we all have to sign to matriculate, and in order to continue with our degrees, to specifically include a mention of any disruption arising from pandemics or epidemics, a limitation of their liability for disruption caused by that. So, I personally, when I complained in November of 2021, I was refused any kind of request for a refund on the very grounds that I'd signed those terms and conditions, which I think is really quite a sad and unfriendly way of dealing with a student community. I think, you know, people in the administration, people like Peter Matheson, who have, you know, bemoaned the sort of toxic debate that's going on around all the finances and have been upset by the tone of the debate. I think that the reality is, sadly, when your response to your students is to treat them basically as consumers and not really as human beings, then the debate does sink to that level.
And this is, of course, relevant to our listeners right now because staff are still on strike, or at least they have been the last few days, last week, and much of next week as well. And I suppose we can only assume that the University of Edinburgh will be making similar savings across this strike.
Yeah, absolutely. They will be saving hundreds of thousands of pounds as they've continued to do over the course of the pandemic.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I do need to say that, of course, Peter Matheson, the University of Edinburgh, are not here to defend themselves. We have stated very clearly their response, that they have set up the Learning Opportunity Fund, which students are permitted to claim funds through as a result of their learning being impacted by strikes and other action. Ed, thank you so much for coming to the studio. It's been fascinating to speak to you on the Fresh Air News Hour. That is all we've got time for today. It's been an absolutely packed schedule. I wouldn't want to use the word chaotic, but it has been extremely busy. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I will be back next week. We have something potentially extremely exciting next week, which I'm not quite able to tell you all about just yet. It's still in the cards and it's still moving very quickly, that situation. But keep an eye across all our socials, our Instagram, etc. And I will tell you all about that. Of course, in the future, the rest of our interview series will be coming with Christian Jardine from the Lib Dems and Tommy Shepherd from the SNP. Until next week, keep on top of things. Stay well. Take a break from the news if you need, because it can be extremely exhausting. Thank you very much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure. And stay well until next week. You've been listening to the Fresh Air News Hour. I've been Ollie Lewis. Goodbye. You're so nice. And if I chose to listen, I wouldn't take your advice. I'm really sorry. Running, that is why.